Ladies and gentlemen, isn't it about time that you peeled back the layers of the American puritanical mystique and considered the topic of sexual intercourse in a thoughtful way? Well, you've tuned into just the right program. We're here to talk about blowjobs, sexual candor, rape fantasies, and chocolate penises in a way that you may never forget. Join five luscious and thoughtful ladies and one curious interviewer for a conversation that went down in an Alphabet City pizzeria. This is what podcasting is all about. Holy Mother of God.
Okay, so I am here with many lovely contributors of the Best Sex Writing 2008 anthology, edited by Rachel Kramer-Bussell, and I think the best thing to do is probably go around the table and introduce yourselves.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm Miriam Dostoevsky. I was the Columbia Spectator sex columnist for 2.5 years, I think it was. And now I'm an editorial assistant at Condé Nast, and I read a column about naked parties, sort of saying that naked parties are, not sort of, actually saying that naked parties are bullshit.
Okay.
I'm Lux Altrom, although in the book I'm credited as Lux Nightmare, which was a name I wrote under in the past. I am editor of Boinkology.com, a blog about sex and culture, and I wrote a piece called The Pink Ghetto on a site called Sexorati, which is about the way that the internet kind of ghettoizes sexual content and makes it really hard to promote and to talk about, even though it's supposedly this free form, free flow of information.
Okay.
My name's Rachel Schuchert. I'm a Taurus. I'm in the sixth grade. I wrote a piece about... It appeared in Hebe magazine, and it's about the eternal question, do Jewish girls give better blowjobs? It's called Big Mouth Strikes Again.
Yeah, okay.
My name is Liz Langley, and I've been a freelance writer for 16 years at a lot of different magazines and publications, and I did a story for Salon.com called Sex and the Single Septuagenarian about the spread of HIV in the elderly population, specifically in Florida.
Okay. And?
And I'm Rachel Kramer-Bussell, and I edited the book. And now I feel like I have to follow Rachel and say that I'm a Scorpio.
I'm a Leo, if it's any consolation.
And you're awesome.
Virgo.
Okay. Well,
you can tell from your full mane of red hair.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, first off, I will ask you individual questions about your respective pieces, but maybe we should start by establishing what sex is. I know that you, Miss Bussell, in your intro wrote, "Sometimes I think sex is a code word for every dirty, naughty, perverted thought anyone ever had." Now that's a lot of territory there, so I ask the group, is sex a code word for things like this? What does it mean these days?
Wait, do I have to go first?
No, anybody, jump in. Feel free.
As a sex educator who works with in a school system, I should actually say that sex is biological gender.
Mm-hmm.
That's the technical term. It's not actually about fucking. That's sex as an abbreviation for sexual intercourse. So, you know, now that we have that on the official...
The well, that's the first definition, though.
You know, now that we have that as the official, you know, go forth. Sex is technically if you're male or female.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly it gets totally taken to other meanings.
I like it when people use the word intercourse and they're not talking about sex.
It's social intercourse.
Isn't that hilarious?
It's socially weird.
You're like, I had intercourse with those merchants.
It's also like the word erect. Like whenever anyone says they erected a statue. Or it's just one of those words, yeah. Kind of tainted.
Could be worse. Could it be whoopee, you know?
Right.
Whoopee, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say that I think sex, and I don't think people think of it this way that often, I wish they did, is that sex is an extension of who you are, and how you act sexually and how you think sexually often has, or not often, almost always has to do with everything you are and everything you do, and it's just sort of an extension and a physical expression or an emotional expression, and I think that people undercredit how important it is.
Yeah. Well, Liz, you've been reigned silent on this question. What is your...
Well, I think it's strange, like the ultimate act of trust, but that you can have with a total stranger and it's still really great. You know, that irony that it can be so many things at the same time. And I think that it's, you know, it can be, it's the most visceral physical experience and a spiritual experience at the same time. It's you know, that extension of everything that you are. It's an extension of everything in a lot of ways.
And I'm just going to defend what I wrote in there because I felt like it was a little bit of tech. No, and I know that that is a big definition, but I think what's interesting is that some of the pieces in the book are about sexual acts or what we would think of as sex or some version of sex. But I think there's other pieces like Miriam's and the one about eunuchs and a couple others that are not about sexual intercourse or having sex, but about sexuality and how sex does affect like our identity, kind of what Miriam was talking about. And to me, that's all part of like what I consider the world of sex. And I think sex, in quotes, is more than just having sex.
And you, in fact, use italics in that paragraph, in that sentence, too. I should know, too. So I guess, is it really a code word, do you think?
I just want to come back and, you know, with my extremely technical definition. No, I want to say I really agree with what Miriam said. And one of the things a lot of people are always have asked me, like, why I'm so interested in sex and why I'm so interested in sexuality. Which to me, it's like, well, why are people interested in the Civil War? Like, it's just a thing to study. But for me, sex is so fascinating because it's this really broad, topic. Kind of it covers so much territory. I really believe in like this holistic model of sexuality, where our sexuality is far more about who we are as a person than what's in our pants. Like it. How you were raised religiously, where you come from, what your background is, shapes who you are in the bedroom, shapes what you find erotic, what you're attracted to, how you react sexually, and what you like. And I think you do learn a lot about a person, which is not to say, like, you sleep with someone and suddenly you know everything about them, but the way that learning about someone's sexuality shapes, can really shape your understanding of a lot of what makes them tick.
Is it then a sort of contextual prism with which to view the rest of society?
Why, yes.
Human beings?
Well, you might say.
And I think that that's kind of true in the sense that what sex is for you changes over the course of your life dramatically. You know, it starts from when the time that you're really little and are just sort of discovering things about your body and like embarrassing your babysitters and then it's sort of, you know, it, you know, then you start to like experiment with other people as you get older, and then you get to like a point where maybe you're like in a monogamous relationship with someone. I mean, it just like it's constant evolving. Evolution and it evolves as you do as a person too, so I think it's really part of your identity. Yeah. Like, and that
I agree with that.
I think part of why sometimes sex is so controversial is because everyone has a different definition of it.
Yeah.
And like what Rachel said, it might mean something to me and mean totally something else to someone else. And so if I'm talking about my experience, I mean, I've generally found that sometimes I'll be making a really personal statement and people take affront at it, like I'm saying something about them. And I think it's because people really, it's hard not to personalize it, and it's hard to see that it can mean different things to different people.
Well, given that sex is individual, a definition that is individual to various people, how then can someone come to some sort of agreement on this?
Sex is natural. Sex is good. Not everybody does it, but everybody
Thank
should.
Thank you.
I think...
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, just from what Rachel said, I think one of the reasons why sex is so taboo and so scary for people also is because it's really, really honest. Well, there's two things. One, it's really honest, and you're really vulnerable when you're kind of exposing yourself sexually, not in the, like, flasher way, but in the sort of, like, emotional way when we're exposing who you are sexually. But I think it's also because people take it a little bit too literally. Like, a lot of the fantasies that we have are us kind of dealing with something that makes us extremely uncomfortable by eroticizing it. Like, a lot of things that people find erotic are really taboo. That's why you have, like, people have incest fantasies or rape fantasies or whatever, and it's not because they think, like, ooh, getting raped would be so awesome. It's because it's this, like, violence and aggression.
Is.
Well, yeah, you know. Violence and aggression and all these things are things that make us so uncomfortable that we kind of have to process them by eroticizing them, and I think a lot of people can't quite make that leap and go down under that level, and they're like, oh, you're looking at rape porn, you must think that rape is good, and I think rape is bad, so this is horrible.
Yeah. It would seem, go for
and
it.
And people projecting their own definitions of what they grew up with, which I think you were talking about, is, you know, people projecting what they think sex is onto whatever it is that you're saying, and that I think is something, you know, like you're talking about, like the ghettoization of sex on the web and things like that, that's, you know, it kind of... which is, well, I'm sorry, I'm stumbling, but, you know, it becomes ghettoized because people are projecting something on it that they feel like it's dirty or bad, and then they project that onto you.
I also think it's one of those things, like, it's kind of like money. It's one of those things that people are just afraid to talk about it because you have to be completely honest in order to talk about it. It's one of those things that people just don't want to engage in because it's easier not to. It's easier to say, hey, that's dirty. Oh, yeah, I like to do that when the lights are off, and then I'm not going to talk about it at all. Like,
you know, call me crazy, but it seems to me that it would be better to ask who are you sleeping with instead of what do you do for work, you know, in terms of a conversational opener. I don't know.
What's your income?
Yeah,
what's your
income?
It depends on who you're sleeping
with. It depends what you're looking for in a sexual partner.
No, well, no, I guess, though, I bring this sort of hypothetical question up because candor is at odds with this notion of being of this restriction, the taboos that we're mentioning, you know. You were mentioning earlier about, you know, well, is rape good or bad? And this kind of brings me into, I suppose,
well,
you know.
Like I think it's bad. We're on the record to say it's bad.
Yeah. No, but I mean, but in the context of a fantasy, maybe it isn't bad.
No, you know, in the context of a fantasy, when people have fantasies about rape, that's a completely different thing from actually being raped. And that's usually far more about dealing with things that make you uncomfortable or about being really turned on by this kind of power thing and powerlessness, more specifically. Like someone who fantasizes about being raped might be into it because it's taboo, or might be into it because it's really hot to think about, like, being overcome and having things happen to you against your will that actually you really like, and just being forced, especially in our culture where women especially are taught to say no, to protect your virtue, to do all these things. It's really easy to eroticize having that power taken away from you and being forced to do these dirty, horrible things that you really, really think are hot.
And then there is, of course, the sort of stereotype that Ms. Schuchert digs up in her essay about this. I mean, I'm wondering, in terms of this Jewish blowjob stereotype, is there not sort of usurping these stereotypes a matter of projecting manifold images? I mean, there's also the image of whether or not one can use one's real name, as Luck's essay points out. And I'm wondering if it's just a matter of just being candid, if it's just a matter of just being upfront about this reality in our society.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I personally, from my own sort of sense of that, is that total candor is not always the sexiest thing for me, you know? And I kind of, I think I'd sort of, you know, and I went to college and was all very, like, experiment. I was in experimental theater, and we were all very, like, my lady hurts today, and, like, you know, and would, like, roll around on the floor together. And then I lived in Europe for a while, specifically in Amsterdam, where sex is very demystified, you know. It's right there up front. There's, like, the sex store next to the grocery store. And I remember I would walk in the, like, outdoor market by my house, and there's this chocolate shop, which would have these sort of giant chocolate penises. And one day I saw this mother, like, buy one and hand it to, like, her 3-year-old, who started, like, licking this, like, big dark chocolate penis, like, in its stroller. And it was like, and then you'd, like, go into these sex stores and, like, you'd be like, I want to buy a vibrator. And they'd be like, yo, what kind do you want? You know, and, like, and they tell you, you know, they're like, this one, it stimulates both the clitoris and the anus. And I'd be kind of like, they'd be like, why are you laughing? It is possible to make, so why would we not make? Like, it's like all very, like, demystified, and there's sort of, you know, it's almost like it's just become, it becomes very sort of pedestrian. And I think for that reason, like, it's in a sense a less sexy society than someone that can, a society that can keep up a little bit of sort of healthy hypocrisy.
I think there's a fine line. I mean, because it's like, I mean, obviously what I do and what some of us do for a living, I mean, is on that other side, but I think that you can have both openness and honesty in sort of public discourse and still maintain some of that privacy and mystery in your own personal life.
Although, I also think that, like, everybody says, like, oh, we live in the post-Carrie Bradshaw world, we live in the world where we can just talk about sex, but it's not true at all. You can't just talk about sex, like, especially in the United States.
Well, and if you actually look at the stuff that Carrie Bradshaw was, like, writing,
it's not really about
sex.
It's
totally not about sex. It's just her whining about how some guy doesn't like her enough.
And how men are like shoes.
Yeah, men are like shoes. Yeah.
But no, I mean, I feel like for me, like, especially now working as an ed assistant at a business magazine, like, yeah, my coworkers were there. Some of my coworkers were there tonight, but it's not like I go in there and broadcast, oh, yeah, my credentials are a Seth columnist. And it's kind of like what you were getting at the Pink Ghetto. It's just like two different worlds, and they don't reconcile. And it's a shame that they don't reconcile.
I know, and
do you think it's a shame, though? I mean, because I don't mind that they don't necessarily reconcile.
Well, I mean, I don't want to be a frigid bitch, but...
No, but I mean, do you want, like, you know, it's like...
But I want to be able to go in there and be like, this is what I do, and, like, nobody's going to judge me.
Right, but you don't necessarily want people to be like, this is... You don't necessarily want to go in there and be like, this is what I did last night.
No. But I want to go in there and be like, this is what I do, and this is who I am.
Then why don't you?
Well, I do to some degree, but I also, like, know that, like what Lux was talking about in her column, that there's a line. You can't have the both of all. You can't have everything, and that's a shame, but it's true.
But at the same time, it does take people to basically just go ahead and step right up and say, hey, this is what I do.
Lux said is I'm not ready to...
sometimes the context isn't appropriate. You know, it's just a matter of knowing your audience, really. You know what I mean?
But who determines whether it's appropriate? That's the big chicken or egg question. Yeah,
you have to. Your mom.
But I will say, for example, I write for Fleshbot, which is Gawker Media's blog about porn and sex. And there is this kind of feeling, it's like, oh, if you become like editor-in-chief of Fleshbot, where do you go from there? Because like if you become editor-in-chief of any other Gawker blog, you're like, oh yeah, I ran Gawker, I ran GridSkipper, I brought in all this traffic, I'm so awesome, and I'm gonna go work at such and such like fancy publication now. If you work at Fleshbot, you're doing the exact same thing. You're held to the exact same standards, but because your content is about porn and sex, there's a different standard of judgment.
Which
and
is interesting because some of the other blogs also deal with the exact same topics, but in a different way.
And I think that's stupid because it's the same job and it should be viewed as the exact same kind of credential.
Well, they deal with it in like a judgmental, snarky way, like instead of actually, like I think sometimes...
You mean
like
the other?
Like anytime there's something about sex, it's always in this, that sort of like weird, like this is gross kind of way. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's people's default. I think it's really easy for people to go to humor or go to, oh, you know, you do that and I'm not of that world. Mm-hmm. Even though, of course, they're doing the same thing or something just like it.
But it was humor that allowed the zipless fuck to become a reality, and Erica Jong paved the way by using humor to actually get the general population understanding.
Do you think Fear of Flying is funny?
Well, I did. That's just me. I mean, maybe I just have a warped sense of humor.
I thought the zipless fuck was an impossible thing.
Well,
I thought nobody actually achieved it.
Yeah. Well, the point is that you know, speaking candidly about something will in fact reach an audience. And so what I'm sort of suggesting here, I mean, maybe this kind of ties into the stigma that Liz references in her essay about the fact that, well, we can't talk about older people who are having sex, which is a very, I think, also a likewise disturbing stigma, that because they are clearly having sex, as you depict.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that is that they don't like being treated like children. Yeah. You know, they don't like being desexualized that way. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's humiliating. It's like you lose so much as you age, you know, and that's one of those things that's like you may not lose it, but people take it away from you, you know. So it's kind of a, and doctors even will not see them, they won't test them for HIV because they don't see them as being sexual, and that's starting to change though.
Yeah,
also no offense, but you try it. Like, my opinion is that, like, you can, I mean, yeah, of course, I obviously agree that being candid will get you far, otherwise I would never have written my column and been as candid as I had been, but, like, it's not black and white at all.
Yeah, I mean, I got, years ago, verbally attacked by somebody for not using my real name in association with pornography and pornographic pictures, and she's like, well, I use a pseudonym, but it's a pseudonym that's easily attached to my real name. You know, it's because she's like, it's my screen name, but anyone could find out. And I think at the time I was like, well, I don't want to be stalked. She's like, well, my information's public and I've never been stalked, and that's a lame excuse. And I'm like,
and you're like, that's because you're ugly.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I mean, as I got older, because I was like 19 or 20 at the time, so my thoughts were not fully formed. But I'm like, the more I got older, I was like, well, first of all, I deserve my privacy. And that has nothing to do... That goes across the board with whatever work I choose to do. And if I choose to use a pseudonym, that's my prerogative. But I feel like it's not necessarily like, oh, I don't want to be stalked, but it is about the fact that I don't want somebody to go in for a job in an investment bank in 10 years, give them my name, have them Google me, and have it be like, porn, sex, porn. Because, you know, regardless of whether or not you're, regardless of whether or not you are ashamed, well, it was more the porn than anything
else.
I know. But you know, regardless of whether or not you're ashamed, I mean, that is a very real stigma that you have to deal with. Yeah. And there's also the fact for me, like, my family, if you use your real name, you're kind of bringing your family into it. There's a lot of considerations that I think need to be considered before people start judging someone and saying that they're ashamed of the work that they do because they use a pseudonym.
And Miriam and I are nodding over here. I mean, I think another factor is, like, your personal life and dating. I mean, it's really not that easy when someone can meet you, Google you, and find out all this stuff about what you've done, and you don't know anything about them. It sucks.
Yep.
Well, if this is the case, then how does one write candidly about an issue like sex?
Well, because you believe that, like, well, at least for me, and I don't want to speak for everyone, like, especially in a college campus, I wanted to write about things that people weren't going to think about unless they read about them, and I wanted to provoke people to think about things that I thought were important that I think people shove away because they're afraid to think of them. And like, you know, and if that, and honestly, I mean, yeah, it sucked when I dated guys who freaked out about my column, but, like, if there was, there weren't really good guys, but... like, it worked out when it needed to work out.
You have to ease them into it, I think.
And I just, I mean, all I'm saying is that, like, it's not just, like, a glamour, like, all pretty roses things. There are things to think about, in, like, on both ends, in terms of what you want to do and who you are.
Go for it.
I was just going to say, I think that's interesting, because there is sort of a fine line of candor, because I think it is important, particularly in this sort of climate and how hostile it's been towards sexuality in, like, the past several years, you know, that there is an importance in being, you know, very candid and bringing some of this stuff up to and showing people that, okay, so this is not just, like, you know, freaks and, like, whatever, people that are easy to demonize. Like, sex is something that is part of everybody's life, and, you know, I think it's important to, like, human evolution to sort of bring it to the forefront and not have it be this, like, totally buried, shameful thing that, you know, winds up causing all sorts of problems. But on the other hand, I think that there, you know, you need to, within that, allow yourself an element of self-preservation in some sense. You know, like, if you're with someone that you really love and they really don't want you to write about them, like, you have to respect that, you know, because, you know, that has to do with you and that's private, you know, like, you know, or if, you know, there's something you really, really don't want your parents to read, you have to, or you have to count on the fact that your parents don't know how to use search engines.
I think also there's one thing that I think is really important, a distinction that's important to draw that doesn't always get drawn, is that there's a difference between being open and candid about sex and talking about your own personal sex life. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times people assume that if you're going to talk about sex, you are going to talk about who you fucked. Like, for example, like, if you say that you're a sex blogger, everybody assumes that you're blogging about your sex life. I don't necessarily even consider myself a sex blogger, partly because of that. And I usually say, like, oh, I blog about sex and culture. But I talk very openly about sex and sexuality, and I almost never talk about my own personal experience because I don't see it as necessary to the conversation that I'm trying to have.
See, that's interesting because I have to say in college I found that it was most useful to relate to people by... I never used names and I never, like, made any clear identifying statements, but it was important to me to sort of put it out there that I was experiencing the same things I was writing about in order to relate to people. But I agree with you, there were lines that had to be drawn.
Yeah, but I think it's different because you were writing more of, like, a college sex column, mm-hmm. where it is kind of like a, hey, here are things you might experience, here are things, and in that case, yeah, being able to be the person that people identify with and saying, like, oh, she's going through the same thing, that's really valuable. Yeah. And then, yeah, you can figure out what lines you're going to draw there.
Yeah.
I don't think every conversation about sex has to be about, well, when I was giving a blowjob, I mean, it doesn't matter. We can talk about, like, blowjobs without talking about my personal experience.
And I think even if you don't talk about your own experience, you still fall into the pink ghetto.
Yeah.
I think
anyone,
even if it's a really journalistic take, runs the risk of falling into that pink ghetto.
This also goes back to the issue in Liz's essay about the stigma. Obviously, you write a college column, and it's anything goes, and it's accepted. Oh, well, she's young. She can write
candy about sex. Well, I wouldn't say that anything goes, and it's just accepted, because I took a lot of shit on campus.
Oh, I'm sure you did, but comparing this to, say, you know, if you're an older person who is blogging, or if you don't fit within a particular sort of body image norm, I mean, how can sex be discussed reasonably or thoughtfully if we're going to constantly sort of put labels upon what can be talked about and who can, in fact, be dwelt upon in sex writing and in sex in general?
I think, again, it goes back to your audience. It just goes back to who are you writing for. If Miriam is writing for a college audience, a whole different thing is going to be appropriate than is going to be appropriate for another different... It depends on who reads your blog or who reads your publication. It's just like a conversation. Like, you might not tell your mother everything that you did last night, but you might tell your best friend. I mean, it's the same exact thing. It's this huge generalization about candor. Mm-hmm. It seems to be very all or nothing. And I think there are a lot of shades of gray. You know, some people you can talk to very openly. I think that publications are just the same as people.
And
you know?
I think one of the benefits, this is sort of like what Lux in your piece, like with stigma comes opportunity. I think one of the positives of putting yourself out there, and no matter what like level or whether it's personal or more journalistic, is that you get all this feedback from people who, whether they have experienced what you have or not, or you know, I think there's a lot of people out there who are never going to become a sex writer, but who want to share these things that maybe they never share with anyone. And I certainly found that I would get a lot of feedback from people who really just wanted to sort of unload.
For all of you, what role has feedback played in your writing?
I guess I would say, because given my particular situation and given that I was on a college campus where everybody is just waiting to bite somebody else, it really taught me to sort of take constructive criticism to heart, but also to take hateful criticism and just say, okay, that just means I'm doing a good job and pissing people off, and that's fine. And I think it really helped me build up a strong sense as a writer of who I am.
I think feedback has been really great for me, because a lot of what I get is people who are just really grateful that I do what I do. And I got a lot of people who are like, wow, I've never seen anything like this. I'm really excited. I really love that you're talking about sex and it's not depressing or all the bad news, that it's really positive and upbeat and happy. And so for me, it just encourages me to keep doing it.
I don't know. I don't have a ton of feedback, you know, unless it's something specifically that I've written. I'm not a blogger, you know, I don't have. So I mean, it's always nice to get sort of compliments if you've written a story online and check your feedback.
What about the blowjob essay? Did you get like
blowjob
negative
essay? Yeah, you know, well, the Jews always complain. Anytime you write anything, it's like, actually, I think probably the piece that I got the most sort of back and forth feedback on was a piece that I wrote for Nerve a while back that was about it was sort of personal, but it was sort of about like a larger trend of just sort of like the sexual stuff that goes on sort of at like Jewish youth group events. And it was amazing, like the war that was raging, and like I would just check in like every few days, and it was crazy. And then you know, various people were thinking like, was that me that like, you know, writing these things? But then but you know, it was interesting, like how it can be very divisive. And there was really a sense, I think, with that story that I had somehow like betrayed something or was telling people's secrets, and you know, not anyone specifically, but like the secrets of this sort of environment, you know. But then other people, I mean, it was about 50-50, then other people would be like, oh my god, that was brilliant, it's so true, that's exactly how it was. So it was very like,
was it the like back and forth, a bad image for Jews?
Yeah, like, completely. Yeah, it's totally that like Jewish collective shaming. It's a Shonda for the Goyim. It's like, you know, it's that, well, how could you do this, how could you write these things, don't you know how people look at us? And that sense that if you're Jewish and you write, you are somehow, you know, responsible for every
representative.
And
Although, of every Jew. I'm discrediting the Jewish people because my mother is Orthodox and I completely understand where you're coming from. But at Barnard, like, I used to get, oh, you're just discrediting the Barnard woman.
Bullshit. Oh, yeah. All the time. No, totally. I think that's...
I don't even identify that way.
I think that that's true. I'm not Barnard identified.
I'm not.
Well, Liz, what have you in this? Do you also, maybe I can also ask, do you need to have a thick skin to be a sex writer?
Yes.
Well, yeah, you, and I think any kind of writer, you know, and I mean, I don't have a specific sex blog. I've done lots of different random freelance pieces, but feedback is hugely important to me, first of all, because a lot of times, depending on the publication, the pay isn't great. So if you get good feedback, it really means a lot. Like, that can keep you going. Yeah. And, you know, the things that people say, sometimes if you're feeling like, you know, you're not doing a very good job at something or things aren't going well, you get an email from somebody that just makes your day and kind of like completely can remotivate you to keep on doing whatever it is you're doing and make you feel great about what you're doing. I don't know. I don't know that people realize how much it means for them to sit down and say something nice to you. Because who else gets that? Like, not everybody gets that at their job. You know, I think it's hugely important to me. Yeah. And as far as the negative criticism, I you know, a lot of times I find people don't take the time to do that. You know?
I definitely found, like, I thought I would get more hate mail when I was writing for the Village Voice, and I only got a little, and it was always really crazy. Like, the guy compared me to Hitler. Oh, I mean, how, it was almost invariably, there were a few, like, constructive criticisms, and then there were these other ones that would just say the most ridiculous things. You just couldn't take it seriously, so... And I think I have a really thin skin, and I still do, which is not great, but I had to sort of learn that both the positive and negative really had nothing to do with me personally. Like, it much more had to do with the other person and what they were projecting or what they thought. And not that I didn't value their opinion on some level, but just that, like, it's so biased in its way that I couldn't take it totally to heart, both the good or the bad, because I think it's really easy if people are saying nice things, like, to get caught up in that too. Yeah. So I think overall my experience has been, like, to sort of discount most feedback unless it's from someone I sort of know and trust, and I'm open to it, but I think, like I said before, I think people come to the idea of sex with so many personal biases that they're not always reading things critically or objectively.
And so often what they say has nothing to do with you and everything to do with them.
Yeah.
Actually, not so often, always.
Yeah, I mean, that's every kind of criticism, really.
Yeah, I had a guy write to me one time and tell me how horrible I was, and write back to me a month later to tell me he had continued to read my column and I was still horrible. And so it's like, you know, like, how seriously can you take that? I just wanted to write back and say, that's so nice. Thank you for continuing to,
Thank you for continuing my suffer.
Thank you for continuing to suffer through my direct.
I should also observe that many of these pieces came from alt weeklies, and I'm wondering if alt weeklies are the way to find this kind of really thoughtful sort of sex writing.
It's funny because there was a piece from the New York Times that I was trying to get that we didn't wind up going with. It was about sex offenders and how they deal with being brought back into their communities, and it was actually a really good piece. I think it's linked on the Best Sex Writing blog, but I actually went to altweeklies.com and looked up sex, and that's how I found Battle of the Sexless, the piece on Unix, and that's how I found a lot of other really interesting pieces. It's not totally comprehensive, but I think there are things that, A, you wouldn't read if you live in New York and it's written in, you know, wherever, so you just wouldn't happen to see that. So I think that having these alt weeklies online, like, helps facilitate that. And I think there are some local stories that are really interesting that are about, like, specific sexual communities, and I kind of wanted a mix of things that were universal to some extent or national, and versus, like, some that were really local. And I think I really am glad that I was able to mix the, like, indie publications and the alt weeklies with the bigger publications. And I don't know, I think they all contribute something to, like, the overall discussion about sex. And I also think that, like, I would love it if, like, if I get to do this again, if there were, like, a business magazine or, like, I think the thing about sex is that you'll read about it in Newsweek and you'll read about it in, you know, Ms., and you'll read about it in, like, Hustler or whatever. I mean, you'll read about it in different forms and in on different angles, but it crosses so many different, you know, boundaries and topics that it, you know, you, if you go to a newsstand, you'll see sex in some permutation in like tons of different publications.
But certainly there are different boundaries for different magazines. The more mainstream you get, the less that is discussed. Do you think that this is a, all of you, do you think this is an obstacle towards this idea of
reporting? I don't think it's so much less is discussed as it's a different type of discussion. Like if you read Jake and Glamour, it's going to be a different type of discussion than if you read Penthouse. Like, it's just a different, it's like what Liz was saying, it goes back to it's a different audience, and like all these publications are about their audiences. And I also think, like, coming from a college newspaper and coming from a time when, like, it became the norm to have a college sex columnist versus not, like, I agree with Rachel that, like, alt weeklies provide this great outlet, but I don't think that that's necessarily the only thing out there.
And I think it's like Wired. I really wanted to find something from Wired or somewhere like that. Like, I think, like, their take on sex is obviously different because they're geared towards a different, you know, segment of
population.
Yeah, but thank you. But I think that's interesting, like the intersection of sex and technology, like that's something I'm fascinated with too. And that's what I mean by, like, I think people wouldn't say, oh, Wired, that's like a magazine about sex, but there is content about sex within it,
everything.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, or in like the Wall Street Journal or whatever, you know.
I mean, even in Portfolio, I mean, I can't really talk about
that's
like,
what
what's
I
coming
mean.
Out, but
yeah.
Like there will, I'm sure that in the next year you will see pieces that have to do with that.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, okay. Well, thanks very much for talking with me and for taking the time out.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.